Are you confused about real food and what's healthy and good for the planet? Do you need the facts about local, organic, and sustainable food? Well, get ready to change the way you eat. Get ready for The Appropriate Omnivore with Aaron Zober.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of The Appropriate Omnivore. We're now into August, which you might not know is National Sandwich Month. As an appropriate omnivore, of course I'm going to use pastured meats for my sandwiches. But the bread is very important too. Bread these days is filled with so many awful ingredients. Wheat itself is often sprayed with large amounts of glyphosate, and then it's often refined into white flour. Plus, bread often includes such processed ingredients as soybean oil, or canola oil, high fructose corn syrup, and many others. Plus, baker's yeast lacks nutritional value. So with the renewed interest in fermentation, we've got sourdough bread. Here to speak with me about sourdough bread is Monica Ford of Real Food Devotee, a delivery service which makes ancestral cuisine using the best ingredients. Monica, great to have you here. I've known you very early on in my real food journey, and I'm glad we can finally do an interview.
Aaron, it's so great to finally be here. I'm so glad we were able to hook up and do this. And I'm so happy we're talking about sourdough bread because I think it's a magical and delicious part of our diet, or can be.
Me too. And I think you're one of the best people to talk about it with.
Thanks so much, Aaron.
So tell us a little bit about how Real Food Devotee came about.
Real Food Devotee was actually almost a surprise business to me. I became interested from a culinary perspective, being a chef, in fermentation. I began to just experiment with a lot of different modes of fermentation and fermenting lots of different kinds of foods and also beverages. And this was about a little more than a decade ago, when I was beginning to do this kind of experimentation, and I would make some of these items for people that I was private chefing for. And what began to happen is that those people began to see healing. So I really didn't know about the health benefits yet. I was just so interested in the magic and transformation that fermentation causes. So a lot of my clients began to see healing from autoimmune disorders, digestive issues, and many other things like eczema and, you know, what you might think are more minor details, minor issues. And then healthcare practitioners that they were connected with would begin to send other people to me. And so suddenly there were so many people who wanted to be empowered through food to do their own healing or to support their healing with a healthcare practitioner, that I had to transform the way I was doing things because I could no longer make it to everyone's home. When you're seeing that kind of healing, it's very inspiring. And so I didn't want to keep it small. I wanted to open it up to more people. So now the format of Real Food Devotee just kind of organically became a website where people in the Southern California area can order online loads of nutrient-dense foods. So it's not just fermented foods anymore. It's bone broth, it's sourdough bread, it's gluten-free foods, it's nutrient-dense opportunities to get more gelatin into your diet, and sweet treats that are actually a nutrient positive rather than a negative or even a neutral. So people order online and we deliver all over Southern California. Your goodies come in a little thermal bag with an ice pack and you just wake up on Wednesday mornings and pop it into your fridge.
I like that you said it organically came about that way. No pun intended, or maybe major pun intended.
No pun intended, but it is really true. It just sort of sprung up of its own volition. I'm really thankful for it because it's allowed me to be empowered in my own health too. So my health began to change as well. And I've gotten to see so much healing and people just being able to have more control in their lives. I think the coolest thing about healing through food is not really just that we're eating healthy. That's really not the point. The point is to remove the pain and issues of the body so that we can move on to what we're really here for, right? Whether you think that's enlightenment or following your purpose or spending time and loving your family and friends, whatever that is, you're freed up from those constraints in the body. You know, you're able to experience that joie de vie, joy of life. To me, real food devotee and the businesses out there that are promoting clean eating and good health, empowerment through food and changing the food system, it's so much more than just the health of the body. To me, it's a much bigger goal and purpose.
Yes, with all the people I've interviewed and all the shows that I go to, I always love hearing people's health transformation stories. What are some of the ways that your health improved through doing this business?
Some of the ways that my health improved, I didn't really think that I was unhealthy at the time. I thought I was healthy, and I was eating lean meat, fairly low fat, lots of veggies, organic food, and low sugar. So I thought I was a healthy person, and I wasn't really having many problems. I was a little tired, and I got a cold once a year, and I had allergies, but I thought that was normal. So one of the biggest changes for me was that I had this epiphany or realization through this experience of this food that that wasn't normal. I began to understand a new normal of good health. So I lost my seasonal allergies, which my doctor told me, you just have to get a shot. There's nothing you can do about that, you know?
Right.
But I lost my seasonal allergies, which really would take me out in the spring. I stopped getting colds, so it's been about a decade since I've had a cold. And at the time, I wasn't able to eat dairy. So I hadn't eaten dairy since I was a child, which was a big deal for me, Erin, because my parents had a couple of delicatessens growing up. And let me tell you, I love me some stinky cheese, you know? So that was a real bummer, but I hadn't had cheese in quite a long time. And beginning to eat this way, so beginning to eat the fermented food, nutrient-dense bone broth from animals that were raised on pasture, and lots of other good fat, began to learn about good fat, I realized there was a new normal, and I began to try dairy. So I tried raw milk. In fact, someone said to me at the time, oh, well, why don't you try raw milk if you don't do well with dairy? And I said, isn't all milk raw? I didn't even know that was cooked. Milk is pasteurized. And when I tried the raw milk, I had no problem at all, which was amazing to me. So I began to make ice cream, and I could eat that again. And it was nutrient dense. It was actually a positive in my health. And I began to make fermented kefir ice cream that was amazing and even more beneficial. Those are some of the ways it changed my health. I also just began to feel more strong. I was working really long hours at the time, and I just became more strong. And through actually bone broth, I kind of began to feel, the only way I can describe this, and I hope that you and your listeners, someone will resonate with this too, that I'm not a crazy person, but I just began to feel more animal, more primal, a little more wild, a little more connected to nature. And I don't know if that's just me. Some of my clients and other people I've spoken to have said, yeah, they could kind of feel that too. But I think it's kind of a reconnection, really, to the power of our bodies, these amazing meat suits we're walking around in. So I just felt really nourished and really so much more powerful. It's a nice way to walk through life.
That's an important part that you bring up about raw milk, and it's something that I often bring up to my viewers, is that a lot of people who believe they're lactose intolerant are actually just pasteurization intolerant. I think about 94% of the people, because there's allergic to milk, and that I don't know if there's a lot reversing it, but when it's just intolerance to it, a lot of times it's just they're having the pasteurized milk and that's what they can't handle.
Yeah, you're exactly right. And it's really interesting. Pasteurized milk, there are many beneficial bacteria it kills, and it denatures proteins, which means they're a different shape when they come into the body that the body is not used to seeing, and it's difficult to digest them. One of the things that it kills is lactase, which is the enzyme to help us digest lactose. And many of us don't have enough lactase to fully digest lactose on our own. So that can cause stomach issues for some people. For me, it caused a huge histamine reaction. When I would have pasteurized dairy, it would almost be like I was having an instant cold. And if I kept eating whatever that dairy food was, I would get almost a full-blown cold, which was really not pleasant. But when you have raw milk, what you're doing is imbuing your gut with that lactase. And so there's actually the enzyme present in that food to help digest that food. along with all the beneficial bacteria. So there's 100 plus different strains of beneficial bacteria in raw milk. So it's really interesting. And the other cool thing that happened for me was when I started having some raw dairy, then if I went out to a restaurant or I went to a friend's house, I didn't have to say, wait, is there butter in this? Wait, is there dairy in this? No, I can't eat this. Instead, I could have some of that food, some of the pasteurized dairy, or even at a restaurant, maybe that dairy wasn't even organic or grass-fed or any of those things. But I could tolerate it then because I had some lactose present in my gut from having raw dairy maybe the day before or something. So it's this really amazing nutrient-dense food, a clean food, a food that from cows that have to be humanely raised, because when your end product is raw dairy, you have to make sure those cows are on pasture, healthy. You're taking a lot more steps to humanely raise the animals. So there's a lot of good points about raw dairy, though it comes with its own digestive devices.
That is amazing. And actually, you went right into the next question I was going to ask, which was if you could handle some pasteurized dairy after doing that. You had talked a little earlier about your family being in the delicatessen business, so then I'm sure that this theme of National Sandwich Month is right up your alley.
Yes, when I saw that that's what we're going to be talking about today, I got a little excited. And it's funny, I've had kind of a week of deli memories. I just did an event with the lovely Hillary Boynton, who wrote the Heal Your Gut cookbook for Gaps Food. And she is kind of revamping the lunches at a local school here in Topanga, California. I went up there and did an event with her and provided fermented water kefir for the kids and some nutrient-dense dessert. And when I was there on my little table, they gave me this tablecloth that reminded me so much of my deli days. And so that actually started the trend this week. I'm excited to see what else I'll be doing.
Love it.
Having to do with deli.
Yeah. I love it. Hillary Boynton's amazing. They're actually making a documentary about her work with school lunches.
Yes, it's very exciting. And, you know, those kids are a great example of how nutrient-dense foods can really change someone's life, because a lot of behavioral issues and just digestive issues and issues that a lot of children in our country and in the world are facing right now due to the broken food system, a lot of those are improving, and they're getting to see that in a school environment. It's so nourishing, and it's really what we need to be giving to our future generations to fortify them. They have a lot of work to do in our world to care for our society and our world, and I think it's really wise to give them that gift.
Yes, so as it's National Sandwich Month, let's get into the sandwich portion of the show, which, as I talked about earlier, with sandwiches, it's, of course, important to have the pastured meats on there, but some say sandwiches are all about the bread, so it's important to have a very nutrient-dense bread, which, as recommended on this show and through the Weston A. Price Foundation and many others, is the sourdough bread. So what makes your sourdough different from others on the market?
Something I really enjoy doing with sourdough is doing a nice long ferment. Now, I never considered myself a baker, to be honest, and certainly not a baker of bread, but I was introduced to sourdough bread, and then I began learning about ancient wheat and also our modern wheat. The current wheat that we use is very hybridized. So over the last 40 or so years, we've sliced and hybridized wheat to make it more gluten rich, because that's much easier to bake with, to have a gluten rich grain. So our modern wheat is very high in gluten. And I think that's one of the things that accounts for so many people's gluten intolerance now. They've been overloaded with gluten in kind of an unnatural way, not the natural form of our wheat. Now, there's a very ancient wheat variety called einkorn, and that's coming up a little bit on the foodie radars now, I think. But I love to use einkorn wheat. It's higher in protein than our modern wheat that we normally use right now, or commonly used right now, high in B vitamins, thiamine. It's very high in the antioxidant lutein. It has a high oxygen radical absorbency capacity. They call that ORAC. So there are a lot of really wonderful properties with it, but it's also naturally lower in gluten because it hasn't been hybridized like modern wheat. So it's a little harder to work with than our modern wheat flour, but Jovial Foods makes a wonderful organic einkorn flour that if there are any bakers out there or any adventurous people who want to try baking, I encourage you to try the all-purpose einkorn flour from jovialfoods.com. It's really wonderful to work with. And I do a long ferment on that, so even more of the gluten is consumed during fermentation. There are also a lot of other added benefits that we know about from fermentation, right? So it's kind of pre-digested in a way for people. And I have quite a few clients that are gluten intolerant who cannot eat regular bread, even regular sourdough that you might get at a local bakery or your grocery store. But they can eat this bread. They can eat this sourdough einkorn that we put on our menu every week and we deliver all over Southern California. And that's really exciting for people. It's exciting to be able to eat a food that we all grew up on. It's a convenience food. We have a fast-paced society. We're all very busy. And it's really pleasing to be able to take a nice slice of bread out and butter it and take it out the door. I think the main difference in the way I like to make sourdough bread is for it to be a really nice long ferment, which gives you a beautiful rise and nice air pockets. And it really cooks beautifully. Also, just a tip for other people listening, if you don't want to make bread, I would really suggest you try sourdough pancakes with this einkorn flour. Oh, those are amazing.
Yes, I agree about einkorn flour. We actually talked about that. That first became big, I remember, back in 2013, and we had a show right here on The Appropriate Omnivore all about einkorn flour with my good friend Peggy Sutton of To Your Health. And you can find that in our archives for the show to learn more about it, because I remember one of the things about einkorn was that they did an ELISA test on it, which is a test to find gluten, and they actually found that, I believe, not all the strains of gluten were found in the einkorn flour.
It's really amazing. I'm sure that the wheat we use now, which was originally sliced off from spelt, was much better for us. But just the way that we've changed it through not GMO, but GM, so genetic modification, has made it quite difficult to digest for many people.
Right. It's important to make that distinction that it was modified. It's different than the Monsanto gene splicing, but it was still a form of modification because those two are often confused. And I also will second sourdough pancakes, because a few months ago at the Weston Price Pasadena chapter, we had Arian Sikorsky of Taste My Culture, and we made some sourdough pancakes. So yes, that's a great one to make, and it's, I would say, easier to make than bread, because I also am not a baker, but after I took home that sourdough culture from that potluck meeting that we had, I'm thinking I might at some point try to make a loaf of bread, but I think before that, I may maybe do pancakes once, or I'm also interested in trying to make a sourdough pizza bread or pizza dough.
Ooh, fun. Yeah, that would be fun too. Yeah, I would make the thing that you like most. We're more likely to eat more of it if we love it, and that's the whole point, right?
Right, and that's something I think we need on the market is more organic pizza dough, because I don't really see any of that, whether it's sourdough or not. Like, Whole Foods has a pizza dough, but it's not organic, so I'd really like to see more of that. I don't know if you've ever made a sourdough pizza.
I have made a sourdough pizza, and it is really fun to do. It's kind of something you have to get into the rhythm of, so I think it's something you have to make a few times before you're really proficient at
it.
You know, you kind of have to get the feel of it. But yeah, I would love to see one of those on the market. That would be wonderful. And I think we are beginning to see so many more interesting, convenient, nutrient-dense products. So I hope that comes out soon. I know that a lot of restaurants now, especially around the Southern California area, are offering things like that. So there's The Rose in Venice that does a long ferment sourdough pizza crust. And then also Blue Ribbon Pizza in San Diego. They do a lovely one, too. And I believe they make some of their sausage as well, which is grass-fed, and it's really wonderful. I don't know if you've been there, but you should definitely go. And anyone in Southern California, try it out.
Yes. Well, thank you for mentioning those. I didn't know about those, but I have noticed more sourdough pizza places, because I'll add two more. One is called Pie and Cone in Eagle Rock that has an organic fermented sourdough pizza. And then there's also Pisana on the west side of L.A.
Yeah, that is a good one.
And so one thing I've noticed, because I have baked a little bit with the einkorn dough, and this was talked about in Wheat Belly about really from the beginning, the issue with einkorn was it was hard to rise, and that's problem I felt when I was trying to make some einkorn cookies. So do you have any secrets to getting the einkorn flour to rise better?
Well, you know, when I first learned to make sourdough, I was given sort of a, what I would consider a very time-consuming or something that required a lot of memory to feed the sourdough starter and keep it really bubbly. And I kind of devised a more lazy way of doing it, but it seems to work really well. So that part is easier. So I feed my sourdough a smaller amount, and I feed it based on how I'm going to be using it. So a lot of bakers end up having extra sourdough starter. And I hated that waste. The einkorn flour, it's an ancient grain. It's kind of precious to me. I don't want to just throw out sourdough starter. So I do that in a little bit more lazy way. The other thing that I find is a really long fermentation or rise time within the dough itself creates a much more even, beautiful, air-pocketed rise. It also has the benefit of being more nutritious because it's easier on the digestion that way. It's more digested or pre-digested for us, and more nutrients are bioavailable in that bread once a longer fermentation has happened. So I think the key is a longer fermentation. That was a long way of answering your question, but hey, this is slow food.
No problem. Yeah, as long as it gets the job done. And there's many types of sourdough starters. Which type do you use?
So my sourdough starter began from einkorn. It's always been einkorn, so this never started. Many people use rye, which is a really easy sourdough starter to start with. And if you're completely new to the game of bread baking and sourdough, you might want to try a rye starter first. There's a good recipe for starting your sourdough starter culture with rye in the book Nourishing Traditions by Sally Fallon Morrell. But mine was always einkorn. The way that you can make a sourdough starter is literally just having water and flour together, whichever flour you're using. In my case, it was einkorn. And for approximately a week, you'll just feed that starter every day, flour and water that you've mixed up in a jar, a little more flour and water every day. And it's fermenting out on the counter this whole week. And by the end of the week, it will begin to get bubbly. It'll go through a little cycle. So you'll feed it. In a couple of hours, it will become bubbly. It will rise, and then it will lower. And that's its little feeding cycle. And that's literally what my starter has been for a decade. It's been alive and working and making bread just like that.
I feel like you're reading my mind because you seem to be leading into all the questions I'm about to follow up with. You talked about Sally Fallon Morrell and Nourishing Traditions. And in a recent online chapter leader meeting with Sally Fallon a couple months ago, she was bringing up that she even has a hard time finding organic sourdough. I know a few places in Los Angeles which make it, and when I heard her say that, I was sure to add them to our chapter resource list as a co-leader of the Pasadena chapter. But when you look at sourdough, I think the amount of products on the market is still low compared to other artisan fermented products, such as kombucha or sauerkraut. Do you see the number of organic sourdough bakers growing in the near future?
I think it is growing and going to grow more. I think some of the hesitation there was the wave that we've experienced of gluten intolerance. I think a lot of food entrepreneurs have shied away from making bread, unless it's gluten-free bread, because they don't see as wide a market for that. And I think part of that is some of what we were talking about earlier, just education. I mean, if I weren't so obsessed with all of the intricacies of foods and ancient foods and ancestral cuisine, then I probably would not know that if I were not tolerating gluten, that I could eat sourdough einkorn bread. I seriously doubt I would know about that. And I bet a lot of people don't know that they might could try it and possibly eat it. When a sourdough is fermented long, or even with organic wheat flour, some people can even tolerate that. So I think a lot of it is education, us not knowing what's been done to the grains, to our whole foods, the history of that, and knowing whether or not we can withstand it. Gluten intolerance has become kind of a hard rule. Oh, I'm gluten intolerant, so I'm just not going to have anything with gluten. And that makes sense. But there are all these little caveats, these food preparation techniques that can actually make something more digestible than it originally was. So I think there'll be more of it as education continues, as we all learn.
That's a very good analysis. It makes a lot of sense what you're saying. When you look at something like meat, it's up because you have a lot of these groups now that are seeing the benefits of eating healthy, grass-fed and pasture meats with certain diets like the carnivore, keto, paleo. That's all accepted. But some of these other things, such as bread and dairy, there's a lot of groups still that don't eat it. So that's why you don't see as many of them. Because we're seeing that too with dairy, that there's a lot more alternative dairies now, and there's still not a lot of regular dairy. And I think we're starting to come the other way on grains, because I have seen now even some paleo say even some white rice is okay once in a while. Paul Jeminet talks about that in The Perfect Health Diet. Now, it's my theory that even some wheat isn't bad, that I think when wheat is truly sprouted or you get one of these ancient grains like einkorn, I think it actually has similar properties to something such as rice. Would you say so too?
Yeah, I would. And I would definitely say it's more nutrient dense than rice, but has more benefits too. But yeah, kind of some similar properties. And I think it's interesting you bring up these other diets, because I think that's also a big part of us seeing less bread options on the market, because Whole30, keto, paleo, carnivore, these are all very low carb diets as well. So I think that's impacting the choices for good sourdough out there as well.
And for those that are on those diets, I know you also make an almond bread. So tell us a little about the almond bread we can get through Real Food Devotee.
Yeah, I do love having a gluten-free option for everything, because particularly a lot of my clients have come to Real Food Devotee because they know that they can support whatever healing journey they're on. And sometimes that is just that they want to maintain great health. Sometimes it's supporting the treatment of something very serious, health issue or a health crisis. So during those times, most people are on some form of an elimination diet, trying to figure out what's going on or trying not to bring in any triggers to the digestive system, or just foods that are more difficult, so more digestive, energy intensive to break down. And, you know, one of those molecules is gluten. Gluten is a more complex protein to break down. So the option that we give for bread is an almond flour-based bread. It's really delicious. It slices, and you can make sandwiches out of it. So it's a really nice alternative, even if it's a temporary alternative until you can transition to other bread items.
I think that you shouldn't give up wheat altogether. You should heal your system, but yeah, don't think that wheat is so much bad, but your almond bread is a great thing for that. Or if other people, if they feel okay without wheat, I'm not so much for trying to say that they need to go back to it if they feel okay without it. One of the things I noticed about your almond bread is it actually uses a combination of almond flour and coconut flour, two types of wheat alternatives and grain alternatives, which I've seen in all kinds of products. And I have seen some people that use a combination of those. Do you think that using those two ingredients together is the key to making the perfect gluten-free bread?
I think that using both of those flours makes a really nice consistency for bread. It holds together more uniformly than many gluten-free breads. And I don't like using the strange fillers and nutrient negative ingredients that so many gluten-free breads utilize. So there's no things like xanthan gum or emulsifiers, fillers. This is coconut oil, a little tiny bit of raw honey, a little apple cider vinegar, some coconut flour, and some almond flour. The almond flour we get is from a biodynamic farm locally here in Southern California. It's organic. Really, it's beyond organic, certainly beyond the official organic certification standards that we have right now. And so it's much more nutrient dense. So not only is the coconut flour and almond flour mixed for consistency and texture and deliciousness, after all, what should we have food, but we should have it delicious. But it's also about choosing ingredients that give us the most bang for each bite. Why should we fill our stomachs with frivolous, empty calories? You know, we should get something out of that. We're doing things all day, right? We need energy for that.
Mm-hmm. And another ingredient I noticed that you don't use is tapioca starch. Do you think that's another one of those unnecessary ingredients that a lot of these gluten-free products on the markets use?
I do. Yeah, I do.
Yeah, I noticed that in a lot, and I guess that does help with the way of having it stick together, which is something that gluten has. Mm-hmm. But you find another way, because it's crazy at how many of those products use that tapioca starch. I feel like, who was the original person that came up with that? And is he getting like royalties from it? Because he has kind of become like the Thomas Edison of those gluten-free products on the market.
Yes, that's so true. Yeah, I don't know. Maybe you and I would be ultra rich if we had come up with tapioca. But yeah, it does hold gluten-free foods together, but it's not necessary. It kind of reminds me of when I first realized that gravy, this is kind of going off topic, Aaron, but
oh, no problem. We like to do that every now and then.
Okay, perfect. When I realized gravy didn't have to be made with flour, so it didn't have to be thickened with flour. In culinary school, chefs are taught how to make the basic sauces, the bases for the main sauces, right? And gravy, that type of sauce, includes using flour in the beginning to make a roux, to make the base of the sauce, to thicken it. And that's just commonplace. It's a rule, right? And that's kind of how tapioca starch is in gluten-free foods. Once I realized that gravy could be made by just reducing beautiful bone broth and using nice organic onions that we caramelize for that nice savory, almost sweet taste, and that you can make a gorgeous, thick, velvety, delicious gravy that way, it has all nutrient positives instead of this one little nutrient negative. Why am I going to add flour to it? It's not needed. And it's not good for us in any real way. It's not adding anything to the mix. So that's kind of how I feel about tapioca starch. It's not adding anything to the mix. I can make that bread stick together and have a nice texture with another ingredient that's actually good for us. So when I make food, and you know, maybe we should all be able to think more about this, I want it to be a positive. I want every part of it to be good for us. I want each part to lift us up, to empower us, to change our health, to give us a better day. When we're better energized and better nourished, we have a better day. We're nicer people. So that's a long way to say I think that tapioca starch is nutritional neutral, and I'd rather use a nutritional positive.
I would agree with that. I think a lot of these gluten-free breads in the supermarkets that you see today, they're filled with processed and conventional ingredients, but I don't think people realize that, because I think people see the words gluten-free and the thing that automatically strikes in their mind is health food, and they have this assumption that, well, if this company wants to be gluten-free, then they must be concerned with organics and all of that, and that's usually not the case. You have some gluten-free products, actually a good number, that use things like canola oil in it, but even the ones that don't, like when they use like a rice flour, it's not necessarily organic. Mm-hmm. A good number of them, they are willing to be non-GMO certified, but I really don't see a lot of organic gluten-free products on the market. I think that's a problem, but we are seeing more gluten-free in general. When I go to the Natural Products Expo every year, I always see lots of gluten-free and grain-free products. So perhaps as we get more of those gluten and grain-free products on the market, we will see more ones that want to actually use organic and real ingredients. Do you think that's the way it'll go?
I think so. Yeah, I think we're seeing a very positive shift towards all of us consumers coming back around to really voting with our dollars. And I think that sometimes it can be overwhelming to look at all the ingredients of every single thing you're buying, but more and more of us are doing that, and more of us are choosing to vote for organic ingredients and foods that are really nutrient dense, not just excluding this one thing we're trying to avoid at that phase in our lives. So yeah, I think there's going to be more and more of a shift toward the organic, nutrient-dense foods that we want to see out there.
Which is very much what this program is about, because all the time on the show you hear me talk about choosing better meats, but we also want to talk about choosing better bread, since, after all, we're talking about sandwiches this month. But let's go into those other things that you put on your bread. Real Food Devotee also offers some of those great items to put on your Einkorn or almond bread from meats to nut butters to sauces. So let the listeners know a little of what some of those things are.
If you go on the Real Food Devotee menu, you'll probably say to yourself, oh, this girl is crazy. She puts too much on her menu. But I get excited to do interesting, new, fun products, and so that we can sort of have this convenience of food that is actually, you know, I source everything from small farmers, from farms I've visited that are really growing with the standards we want to see. And not only that, but that have good employment practices and that are just all around beneficial businesses, beneficial farms that are good stewards of the earth. So some of the convenient foods that I have for spreading on bread would be things like some fermented cashew cheese, which is really delicious. Of course, organic cashews, they're sprouted, and then it's fermented into a flavored mixture. So we have a turmeric pepper, and we have a truffle, and then we have cultured vegan butter for people who need to stay off dairy for a little while. So maybe if you're in the beginning of stages of the GAPS diet or on Whole 30, then you can enjoy that. It's made with great nutrient-dense oils like avocado oil, coconut oil, and has pink salt and turmeric also. And then we have a pasture-raised chicken liver pate, which is incredibly nutrient-dense. So we've got pasture-raised eggs in it, garlic, onions, mushrooms. And really, I made this particular pate recipe because I didn't grow up on liver. So it was hard for me to eat liver, really hard for me to eat liver, and hard for a lot of other people too, I think. Liver became unpopular. And so many of us didn't grow up on it. And it's a strong taste for a lot of us. So this recipe is so that people like me can enjoy pate and get all of those wonderful benefits. As many of us know, the liver of a well-raised animal is incredibly nutrient-dense. It's a sacred food in many native societies, and it's really an incredible food for people who are experiencing things like adrenal fatigue, which is so common now in our kind of fast-paced world. So pate as well. We do an almond butter that is, of course, sprouted, and organic almonds, of course, some coconut oil, a little bit of mineral-rich pink salt. We do a fermented raspberry sauce, an umami shoyu koji, a little Japanese fermentation. Just so many things. I could go on and on and on, but I don't want to take up all your time on the show just listing the menu. But if anyone wants to see the menu, even if you're not in Southern California and maybe can't get a delivery, if you want ideas for what you're making at home, go to realfooddevotee.com and just check out the menu. And you might say to yourself, oh, I don't love sauerkraut, but look, I could make this fermented raspberry sauce. And check that out. There's always something interesting for each of us, no matter what our taste bud proclivities are, right? There's something for us that's nutrient dense or fermented. We're just kind of what we think of when we think of fermented foods, for instance, is just pickles and sauerkraut usually. But there's so much more, so many more options. And that goes for every single category. So take a look and see what you want to make for yourself at home. Mix it up in the kitchen.
I'd love to try your liver pate because, like you, I also did not grow up on liver. And I have to confess, even to this day, when I eat just a regular liver, I don't like the taste of it so much. So with me, I typically get my liver through mixing it with something such as ground beef and, for instance, making my award-winning chili. Although I haven't made the chili, actually, in the competitions I've entered with the liver beef blend because it's for more of a general audience. You gotta know your audience, but for myself, I make it with that and I think it tastes good. It's pretty much the same thing. It has all the same seasonings in the chili and stuff, just it has a little liver in the ground beef versus the other times I made it with just ground beef.
That sounds so good.
I think so.
If we put it on a sourdough bun, we can call it a hamburger helper-ish or something. It can still be a sandwich, right, Aaron?
Absolutely. Yeah, sandwich is a broad term. And that's actually what I want to get into next is, what's your favorite sandwich to make?
Gosh, that is such a hard question because I grew up in a deli. So my dad made these really wonderful sandwiches. But one of the ones I liked the most, still like the most, is a muffaletta. A muffaletta is a sandwich that originated, from what I can find, in Louisiana, in New Orleans. Originally, when it was made, they would actually use chicken fat, schmaltz, bread on the bread first and then toast it, and then they would put the rest of the ingredient. My dad didn't do that at our deli, but he used a little olive oil on the bread. But the sandwiches are the way he made it. There are a few different variations, but the way he made a muffaletta was to use salami, ham, this mixture, kind of a Italian herb, spice, green, black, olive, and celery mixture, and he would put that on the meat, and then Swiss cheese and provolone cheese, and it was kind of on a sesame seed bun. Oh my gosh, so good. I make them now and then, now with nicer ingredients, better sourced ingredients, but it's just ultra delicious, super satisfying. There's something really satisfying about a sandwich.
Absolutely. That sounds like one I'd love, because that's one of my favorite sandwiches, is having those Italian cold cuts. So I like to get my Ollie salami and my liquorice prosciutto and put that on a sandwich.
Yum. That sounds great.
That does. Of course, another kind of sandwich, although some people debate me about this is a sandwich, like we were talking earlier, would chili between two pieces of bread be a sandwich? Is I argue that a hamburger is a sandwich. So let's settle this on the show. Do you think a hamburger is a sandwich?
I think it is, but I'm not a huge stickler, I guess. But yeah, I think it's a sandwich. I think really anything you put between two pieces of bread should qualify as a sandwich, shouldn't it?
It is. Yeah, people are so conditioned to think of a hamburger as something else. I know I was that way, because I remember in grade school we had to do a paper on what is your favorite sandwich, and people went up there saying a burger, and I'm like, burger? Oh, well, that's my favorite, but I don't think of it as that. And then you have some of these restaurants will say on the menu burgers and sandwiches, but you will actually see some restaurants where it says sandwiches and you see burger under there, but we're so conditioned to think of a burger as something special, yet when you look at it in the dictionary, it does say under the definition of burger, it typically lists in most of them sandwich, so I think it's all just a mindset that we don't look at it that, but I'm glad that we agree with that. And all of my friends that are listening now, they now are hearing two people who work daily with food that are saying it is a sandwich.
Yes, if you really strongly believe a hamburger is not a sandwich, please, I don't know if there are comments when you post this, but please let
there
us
are,
know
yes,
why
on the webpage
you think it's not.
And on iTunes. I'd love to hear people's reason for why it's not.
I'm open to learning.
We sometimes like to get away from a little bit of the topic, a little bit of the appropriate omnivore thing to just talk about something like that on the show. But getting back into it, you talked about how you have the delivery service, and you're also available in some stores here in Southern California. What are some of those places where we can find Real Food Devotee in the supermarket?
The way that my business organically came about, I kind of resisted doing stores for a long time, which a lot of other food entrepreneurs thought I was crazy. But I really was kind of drilling down on what I was perfecting, the products I was making, and really interacting with my client on a deeper level than just making food. So I have opened up, though, to some stores now, so I'm just beginning to do that. A great little store in Pasadena, and I know you know it well, Culture Club 101.
Yes.
The founder, Elena Luther, and I are just kind of foodie soulmates. So we have a lot of the same food philosophies and a lot of the same healing goals and goals of changing the food system in general. I place quite a few of my items at her little shop in Pasadena. And then there's also a great spot for juices and snacks as well. Lots of just clean eating and drinking options over in Eagle Rock, and it's called Eagle Rock Juice. They're a great place to go into, just kind of a fun little shop even, to go look around and see all of the healing options they have. And then there's another great store called Grassroots Market. They also have a cafe, so they're in South Pasadena. One of the things I love about what Grassroots is doing is they're carrying the bone broth I make in their freezer section, so you can get it packaged, but they're also offering hot cups of the bone broth I make in their cafe. And so this is really a huge innovative thing we're seeing, and that they're kind of helping to pioneer and push this wave forward. Being able to go to a cafe, this is one of my dreams, right? Just stopping off somewhere in a fast food way, getting something that's super nutrient dense. So for instance, the bone broth I make with pasture-raised bones, be that from beef or from chicken, and then we season it. I found that, like, and you can tell me if you think this is true, and Aaron and anyone in the comments, do you find that a lot of the broths on the market are so plain tasting? There's not a delicious richness there. Where is the seasoning? Where is the body? Where are the layers? It's like we took this health food and just said, we just want to make something that we've heard is healthy, so it's just going to be bones and water. And really, we need to think about making all of these health-promoting foods super delicious. One of the things I like to do, and I guess it's kind of the same idea as the pâté, I wanted to make something that you really enjoy drinking. So cool to me that you can go to Grassroots Market in South Pasadena, order up a hot cup of bone broth. Don't have to get coffee if you're not feeling like it. You don't have to get tea if you're not feeling like it, or a soda. You can get a warm cup of bone broth that is full of gelatin. It will support the collagen in your body. We actually have more collagen cells in our bodies than we have muscle cells. It's something we need to support our skin, our nails, our hair, our joints, our gut lining. Many of the other different systems in our bodies use collagen. This is a super nutrient dense food. It also lowers inflammation in the body. I like to think, I've been told by many, that this broth is delicious. And that is really my goal when making it. We get all the great ingredients, but then you have to make it taste beautiful. You have to use the right cooking methods. So like, for instance, our chicken broth is cooked for 24 hours plus because we want to get all the minerals, all the gelatin from those well-sourced bones. And for the beef, it's 48 to 72 hours. So same thing. I just think it's so cool that you can not only buy these items in their freezer section for you to take home, but you can just go get a cup just like you're ordering a latte. A really beautiful thing.
I've been saying that for a while, that broth could be the new coffee. And I think that is very important, yes, to put the flavors. I think perhaps a lot of these ones on the market, that really hasn't been their focus, is to drink the broth just itself. They make it more for if you're going to mix it into something like a soup or other ingredients that call for broth. Or then they go the other way and go kind of the full route of actually making now fully made soups that you can buy with all the ingredients in it. But you don't have something in the middle where it's not just a plain broth to mix in to make your own soup, and it's not a fully made soup. So I think that what you're doing is something that is needed more of on the market.
Yeah, I think it's nice. And bone broth is a big undertaking to cook yourself. While I think it's wonderful for people to make it, and I do teach people how to make it, I live in reality. I know we all have a busy life. I know we work 40 plus hours a week, most of us, or have kids, or sometimes it's not practical to make all your own bone broth. So it's really nice to just be able to go get some, go pick it up, just like you buy anything else. Why can't we buy something good for us, right?
Absolutely. And I do recommend for people that live in the Southern California area to go to one of your classes. Speaking of Elena, I remember this was back in, I think, 2013 when Day-Day's Farms had their last open house, sadly, that you and Elena did a talk all on bone broth for people that were attending the tour.
Yeah, I remember that day. Yeah, you're speaking of John De Bruin, who was a wonderful proponent of the movement of real food and grass-fed farming. He's a really interesting person. He was a rocket scientist. He worked for NASA for most of his career. And then in his retirement, he and his wife began a grass-fed beef ranch in the area of California near Los Alamos or Santa Barbara, a really beautiful area. He was a staple at the farmers markets for quite a long time, and he held events like that that were educational and really got people in touch with what was going on in his ranch and how that was different from the confinement feeding that we're seeing, which is really not only abuse of animals, but abuse of the earth. And we can take that further to say abuse of our people as well, because there is really no health benefit to that meat.
Right. So we're just about out of time, but before we go, why don't you tell the listeners where they can find the website for Real Food Devotee?
Yes, I welcome anyone to come over and visit us at realfooddevotee.com. That's realfooddevotee.com. Also, Real Food Devotee on Instagram. We like to post lots of interesting facts about real food, lifestyle choices that can help to lower stress and just help to promote health in general. Really, my goal is to help us all be empowered to take control of and be in the driver's seat of our own health and the health of our loved ones. So I'd love for any of you to join me in either of those places. And please feel free to reach out with any question. I love to connect with people, and I love to learn about other people's healing journeys and what they're doing in their lives in the realm of food and healthy lifestyle choices. So please come over and join in the conversation.
Excellent. Well, it's been a pleasure to have you here for National Sandwich
Month. My pleasure. Thank you so much, Aaron. This was so fun.
That's all for this episode of The Appropriate Omnivore. Tune into my podcast next month when I interview holistic health coach Ellen Jaworski of Triple Peak Wellness as we talk about getting healthy habits back on track. As always, you can hear my old podcasts on iTunes, Stitcher, and on my blog, appropriateomnivore.com.